we had our plan. The flight was delayed half an hour. There was traffic on this one. We got to the other one. There was traffic on that one. And so you had, but the nice part is you had nice long kirtan. Chanting of Krishna's holy name. And from what I understood from Vibhu Chaitanya, that there are a number of persons here who are his co-workers, colleagues at work, and I'm going to primarily address all of you, so that, can you sit a little bit over here so we have some eye contact there? There we go. I'd like to speak about Bhagavad Gita and kind of an introduction to Bhagavad Gita, because Bhagavad Gita is an introduction for all of the vast Vedic literature. I'd like to speak primarily on three things. See if I can capture them properly. Huh?
Yeah, the horse.
What's that?
Yeah, the horse sitting to the river for the hour and contact the horse.
Okay, where are they?
Mountain view.
Okay, why don't you move? Okay. I think I'll skip Vibhu Chaitanya, you see there? We're going to skip the projector because it's too confusing. I saw the projector and I thought, oh, it would be really nice because I could, in addition to what I'm going to say, you could see it and hear it, and, you know, it's, there's a Bhagavad Gita interactive that's very entertaining and very educational. But I think it's too confusing at this stage to try to do that. So, the Vedic literature is very, very, very vast. The word Veda means knowledge. So it's like, you know, encyclopedia, you could say, or the university of all knowledge in a written form. And what's that hum?
It's the chakra.
Oh, really?
It's a 12-volt fan.
Make a lot of noise. Can we do it after chakra while during the talk?
I can take it.
Okay. This is for the plug, no? Okay. Technology has its advantages and disadvantages, like anything. Okay. Veda means knowledge, and in the whole of Vedic literature, there are philosophical portions. They are called Shrutis, and then there are those literatures that explain the Shrutis, and they're called Smritis. So both together combined make the whole of Vedic literature. And there's this one portion that Bhagavad Gita is within, is called Itihasa. It's a history. It's an epic of, literally, the title Mahabharat means Greater India. At one time, according to Mahabharat, there was one king or emperor that ruled virtually the world. And the capital was in Hastinapur, which is now New Delhi. And there were many other kings but there was one emperor above all those kings. And in Mahabharata, it's a within the history is, from a literary point of view, is a classic good versus evil struggle. And guess who wins? Yay, good always wins. Although it may look like evil is dominating, but from a religious point of view, it's how to face adversity without abandoning virtue. And many lessons that are actual histories of a very virtuous lineage of kings that got in conflict with the same royal family that abandoned virtue and took up greed and power and control, and then, you know, without virtue, skullduggery and anything to get their objective. Murder, attempted murder, intrigue, all those things. And then the royal family that was, by religious law and the law of the land, to inherit the kingdom, were placed at odds with their cousins. And there's lots of detail. Very, very interesting detail. But taken as a large work, it's lessons in how to be virtuous. And even how to perform your duty. This is like, you know, drill a little more deeply. How to stay faithful to your duty, not abandon duty, but not abandon virtue while staying faithful to duty. Because sometimes there's compromise, you know, if you do the expedient. But the personalities in Mahabharata, the Pandavas, they were the emblem of virtue, especially the eldest brother, Yudhishthira. So there are these wonderful lessons in ethics and morality and virtue. But the Bhagavad Gita takes one beyond doing good into the realm of transcendence. In the realm of transcendence, not only what you do should be what is on the side of virtue, but the message of Bhagavad Gita, its enduring feature and quality, is that it speaks about doing what is good in pursuance of the ultimate mission of life, or the soul's journey back to God. And it does it in a very interesting way. It's right, literally right in the middle of Mahabharata, so it's like, you know, there's the bread on this side and the bread on that side, and then there's the what's in the middle part. They're really, what all the bread's for is the middle part, the transcendence part. And these virtuous brothers have exhausted all possibilities of avoiding a combat, a war between cousin brothers. And just before the battle is to begin, one of the chief warriors, Arjuna, requests his chariot driver, who is Krishna, to show him draw his chariot in the middle of the two armies and see who is on both sides. And when he sees who is on both sides, he collapses. He can't go through with it. He drops his bow. The valiant, chivalrous, virtuous Arjuna drops his bow and says, "I shall not fight," and gives his reasons why. Virtuous reasons why. And there, you listen to his reasons, and they're really good reasons on the side of virtue. But then he really doesn't know ultimately what his duty is. So he turns to Krishna. Very important, like transition from the whole of the Mahabharata, his dear friend Krishna suddenly becomes his instructor, his teacher, or his guru. And he requests Krishna, I do not know what is best for me to do, please instruct me. It's a turning point of the drama of Mahabharata, good and evil struggle, to now move into the realm of transcendence. So, the mood shifts. Krishna, not just his friend, becomes his teacher, his guru, his supreme authority. And what Krishna says, paraphrasing, before we decide or discuss what your duty is, let us talk about who you are. Now we can talk about what your duty is. So, in that very beginning part of Bhagavad Gita is this wonderful discussion about the soul. And the soul is who we really are. And duty is not just in terms of the body, who we aren't, although there are codes of morality and ethics which the whole of Mahabharata is framed in. But what's the purpose behind those codes of moralities and ethics that are universal? Any culture will have very similar codes of morality and ethics. But what's the purpose behind them? Or who are we? Poignant question that many people pass their whole lives at their other end of the conveyor belt and they still don't know who they are. So the circumstance is a very critical one, and it brings forth Krishna's address to Arjuna about the soul, the real identity of the soul. I'll only very quickly summarize, and if we had this another time we can do it. Another time we can do it. The nice Bhagavad Gita interactive that depicts what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita in graphic form. And nice music and a few beautiful images. It's very easy to follow. Essentially, the soul is qualitatively distinct in a category altogether different than matter. Just for starters, sat and asat, or eternal and temporary. The soul doesn't come into being, has never come into being, and will never come into being. Souls are eternal. And we can't say that about bodies, or even the elements, because within the process of creation, even the elements, they become manifest, they're sustained for some time, and they're withdrawn, but the soul is not. It's everlasting, undying. Krishna says things like, the soul can never be moistened by water, or withered by wind, or burned by fire, or cut by any weapon. Meaning, from the Vedic context, it's not made of earth, water, fire, air. Because objects of matter, they're made of those things, and they can be eliminated by, or reduced by, or changed by the influence of the elements. But the soul is not of the material elements and can't be brought into being nor taken out of being. It's eternal, undying, ever existing. The soul is not slain when the body is slain. And that eternal soul in this life, transmigration of the soul is explained. The soul during this lifetime is giving up one body and accepting another body. Just like, how old are you now?
Six.
You're almost. It's funny, when you're young, you're almost something. Okay. And what's your name?
Sahar.
Sahana. And have you seen pictures of when you were a little baby?
No.
Somewhere in your house. Your mom has some pictures of when you were a little baby.
No.
No? I bet she does. Your daughter? You have some pictures. Okay. Let me ask you this. If you saw, here's five pictures of little babies, and one of them is your baby picture, would you know which one it is?
No.
No. Not only that, where is that little baby body now? It's gone. And now you're almost six. But let's imagine that you're 15. Cool, right? 15. And when you're 15 and you see a picture of when you're almost six, where's that body that was almost six when you're 15? The answer is it's gone. Right? It's here now. By the time you're 15, it's gone. And then, you know, keep going like that. When you're 40 years old, that 15-year-old body's gone. You're getting sad already, huh? You get the idea. You get the idea. The soul, but you're still around. When you're in a little baby body, you're there. And now you're here. And when you're 15, you'll still be here. But the body is going to be gone. So what does that mean? If you think about it, we're something other than the body. That's what Krishna is teaching Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. If you can move a little bit, then I can see your friend. Okay, very good. Okay, you got the idea. Krishna's teaching Arjuna that in the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, the real you is a spirit soul. And that spirit soul is meant to be engaged within the body in activity. So the next lesson to Bhagavad Gita is, I'll go very quickly, next lesson to Bhagavad Gita is how to do your homework. You know, don't make messes in the house and listen to your mom and dad and everything's nice and you do all your duties, but without attachment to the fruits of what you do, or even without attachment to the idea that you're doing things, but to do them as duty or in service to the Supreme. That's another level of consciousness that Krishna explains. And if you want to do things for the Supreme, then you need to know who is the Supreme. And what's the distinction between the Supreme and this individual spirit soul? Qualitatively, like a spark is to a fire, they're the same. Quantitatively, very different. We're far from the Supreme. Quantitatively. And so Krishna is disclosing his identity to Arjuna slowly, slowly. And in the process of understanding who is the Supreme, entering more deeply into knowledge of spiritual reality and ultimately our eternal loving relationship with the Supreme. And then you go back down to the duties of life, and sometimes there's challenges. You know, in different stages of life, there's different challenges, without detailing them. How you can be happy with all your friends, and sometimes they may say something that hurts you, but you still want to be friends. Or sometimes your teacher may give you a lot of homework, and it can be very challenging how to do all that homework. But you still have to go on and do your duties of life, and so on. So there's challenging circumstances at every stage of life. But how to stay, the teaching of Bhagavad Gita is how to stay in a spiritual conception always fixed in the proper execution of duty unto the Supreme. Not abandoning virtue, but also not abandoning the goal fixed upon the Supreme. So Krishna is teaching gradually through the course of Bhagavad Gita how to do that. It's why it's such an enduring literature. It was written 5,000 years ago, and to this day, something that's written 5,000 years ago may be interesting to people 5,000 years ago, and maybe you read it like some people might read, you know, the works of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, or, you know, maybe something from some culture somewhere, and it's, you know, it's fascinating, and just like Moby Dick or something, some classic literature, struggle between good and evil, it's nice. But the enduring nature of Bhagavad Gita is that the message carries one to the position of being fully conscious of the Supreme. One feature of Bhagavad Gita that's very wonderful and unique and special is that many scriptures of the world, or I should say most scriptures of the world, are spoken about God. And Bhagavad Gita is a scripture that's spoken by God about Himself. When I was growing up as a young boy, we regularly referred to the Bible as revealed scripture, because it reveals God. And this is revealed scripture where God is revealing Himself. That's very wonderful. Not that others can't reveal God, but when he's in the Bhagavad Gita, he's describing to Krishna, that means also unto us, he is revealing his own heart, his feelings, how he feels towards all groups of people in general. He says, Samoham sarvabhuteshu name dvesho stina priyaha. He says that he's Sama, he's equal towards all living entities. Neither does he feel dvesha, feel like negative, like have bad feelings towards anybody. Nor does he have particularly, you know, favorites. Na priyaha. But he's equally disposed to all living entities, like a father is equally disposed to there is many children. And God has so many unlimited living entities who are His parts and parcels. So He speaks of the living entities that way also. Mami Bhangsa Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. Sanatana means eternal. They're eternally my fragmental parts and parcels. So He feels affinity or equal affection towards all. But he also discloses his heart when he describes those who are situated in love and devotion towards him, how he feels towards them. The picture that Bhagavad Gita discloses is that God is all-loving and he simply reciprocates our disposition towards him. There's directly a verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says that. Yayatamam prapadyante tangstataiva vajamyaham. Prapadyante means surrender. So, paraphrased, as they are disposed towards me, I simply reciprocate their disposition towards me. He has no dvesha or ill will towards any living being. But if someone is, God is dead, or God should be dead, or some ill will. He doesn't feel ill will, but he reciprocates. Well, you like to be my enemy. All right, I can act like that, your enemy, if you like. You like to love me. Very well, I'd like to love you. And his feelings towards those who are advanced or matured in their spiritual path by following the indications that he gives, he describes how dear they are to him in many, many ways. So it's wonderful that God is disclosing his feelings. Because how else would we know what God's feelings are? It's nice to hear somebody who's dear to him and they know his feelings, but he's disclosing it directly. For those reasons, Bhagavad Gita is enduring. It's not a time in history. There's a certain group of people that thought a certain way. Bhagavad Gita can be looked at that way, but one will miss the essence of Bhagavad Gita if one looks upon it that way. It's an address by the personality of Godhead to all living entities who are within this world, how they can return to the spiritual world. The picture is that living entities have their eternal loving relation with God. And by misuse of free will, because living entities are, by constitution, they have free will. We'll back up. Using the example again of a spark onto a big fire. What the qualities of the spark is the same as the qualities of the big fire. It gives off heat and light. But its quantity is very tiny. So Krishna is the big fire, and we're the little spark, and we have qualities like him. So in the quality like God, he has knowledge. So we have some knowledge. We have some happiness. He has all happiness. He has unlimited free will. So we have this little tiny free will. But it's quite tiny. And with that free will, we can properly use it. But we also can not properly use it. I was explaining this in Nashville, Tennessee today. About free will. A group of Tennessee folks. And the idea of, it was part of the discussion, was free will. And free will is something that's intrinsic to the soul. The soul can't abandon or give up free will. We can misuse it. But just like, an example, somebody, say everybody in the room, at the end of the program, we have a $1 million check waiting for you as a thank you gift for coming to the program. So please enjoy the use of that $1 million check. Wow, $1 million check. So depending upon the free will of the living entity, they may use it in a very beneficial way. And they may use it in a very detrimental way. And it's a matter of free will. So the living entity is in that position where we have free will. Then on this side, because we're in Sanskrit is called tatastha, we're marginal. Marginal, the example of marginal is from the Vedic literature, where there's a river and there's the river bank. And then there's this little line where the river meets the river bank. So where the river is very clear. Where the bank is very clear. But where the river meets the river bank, that's neither here nor there. Or it's marginal. And the living entity is marginal. And depending where we direct our free will, our consciousness, we can be on the spiritual side or influenced by the spiritual potency of God. That's one free will choice. Or we can direct our attention, consciousness, and free will to the spiritual energy, trying to be the enjoyer of material energy, trying to be the enjoyer of the material energy. That's a free will choice. And it sounds like, okay, we just like, boom, I just choose that one instead of this one, or this one instead of that one. Boom, boom. But it doesn't work so quickly like that, because once in contact with the material energy, we become conditioned by the laws of material energy, and we identify very strongly with that which we're not. The coverings of the soul, the mind, the body, our language, our culture, our gender, our race, our age, six, I'm almost six, and so forth and so on. We identify falsely with who we're not. And then the subtle, the thoughts and the emotions and the feelings and the likes and the dislikes and my friend and my enemy and all those things, all those designations that are distinct from the soul. And our whole reality is built up in what's called Maya or illusion, that which is not. So the lesson of Bhagavad Gita is to withdraw consciousness from the illusion, place consciousness on reality. Hari Bol Madhava. Place consciousness upon reality and then execute the duties of life in harmony with reality, the supreme reality, the proper use of free will. And slowly, slowly, step by step, the lesson of Bhagavad Gita is to take us into that realm of the eternal. And when one's consciousness is fixed like that, Krishna describes, when the body is finished, the soul enters into that realm of the eternal. And the converse is also true. If one's consciousness is absorbed in the temporary, by transmigration, the soul takes another body within the realm of that which is temporary, depending upon the activities that we perform here in our present life. We're presently determining what that next situation of life is going to be, which is true even now. Now, when you're doing your homework, somebody might ask you, I'll ask you, what's your best subject in school? Are you a math student?
Math.
How about English? Okay. Maybe math and science. Maybe you're too young to know the difference. But anyway, someone develops some propensity like this, and then so they go on and they're determining their, you know, not only how they spend their time and what type of occupation or activity they'll be engaged in, but literally we're developing our bodies by our present choice of activities. Somebody may be very athletic, somebody may be very scholarly, somebody may be all kinds of things. Artistic. Where's Prahlad? He's behind. Okay. After every program, Prahlad gives me a little painting of something he's drawn. So he's inclined to art. Madhav is inclined to play. So, according to propensity, we do activity, and according to our activity, we're developing a body, even in our present life, and the same principle applies. When the body is finished, the soul goes to that which is according to our quality and our work. And thus, we direct our free will and our consciousness to the soul, and to this relationship between the individual soul and the supreme soul. And that's called yoga, linking our consciousness with the supreme. So there are different systems of yoga within Bhagavad Gita. It starts with Sankhya Yoga, and then Karma Yoga, and Gyan Yoga, and Dhyan Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga, and so many other divisions of yoga. But the principle of yoga is linking oneself with the supreme. So it starts with understanding who is oneself, even in terms of worldly duty and how to adjust virtue and not be succumbed to vice or greed. Or the flip side is what Arjuna wanted to do, not perform duty, abandon duty, prescribe duty, because the consequences look not desirable. So non-performance of duty is another apparent choice, But Krishna rules it out. Says you don't perform your duty, and you're bound to a bad reaction. So you can't not perform duty, even if it's difficult. How to do your duty, even if it's difficult? In proper consciousness. Right, Madhava? Okay, so there's a little introduction to Bhagavad Gita. Now, I'm particularly speaking on this topic and in the way that I'm speaking for those of you that are kind of not accustomed to our the Bhagavad Gita and Kirtan. So I'd like to invite you to raise questions and see where the discussion goes. A fellow Vaishnav, god brother of mine, Bibi Madhava Maharaj, is visiting from who knows where. A traveling mendicant just came in for a landing to give his association for a while. So we'll share responding to whatever questions you may wish to ask anybody. But particularly I'm inviting our persons who are rather new to this message of Bhagavad Gita. So any comments or questions? Yeah.
So you said like we have to surrender to God, like so he if you show love to him, so he's going to show love on us. So how do you show love to God?
Nice question. Let's go, I could give a quick answer, but let's go back. One of the ways that Krishna is showing Arjuna, it's a very special situation between Krishna and Arjuna, because Krishna says to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, I'm explaining this to you because you're my bhakta and you're my sakha. You're my dear devotee and my dear friend. So Arjuna already knows. But still Krishna is explaining, because he's explaining, Prabhupada gives this example where the mother wants to instruct the daughter-in-law. But he doesn't want the daughter-in-law to be uncomfortable. So she'll instruct the daughter in the presence of the daughter-in-law. And then the daughter-in-law will understand, oh, that's what my mother-in-law would like. So, it's very nice. Similarly, Krishna is instructing Arjuna. Arjuna already knows. But he's taking the position of one who doesn't know so that Krishna can instruct us. We're the daughter-in-law in this case. And the way that Krishna instructs Arjuna is, if you want to please God, first, try to understand who you are. Then, try to understand who he is. And as best you can maintain some nice understanding of who you are and who God is, then try to do things that are pleasing to God. Because it's very easy to just say, okay, here's some things that you can do that are pleasing to God. Like the chanting of God's holy name. That's pleasing to God. Not pleasing to God because he's self-indulgent. He just likes to hear his name sung. He's pleased because it's purifying for us. And it's because by chanting God's holy name, the natural consciousness of the soul is cleansed. The coverings of impure consciousness are removed. And the dormant consciousness of the soul is restored. That's pleasing to God. I mean, think of yourself as a mother and with your daughter. When your daughter shows, like, you know, character, not just she cleans her room when you tell her to clean her room, but she does it because she knows it's pleasing to you. When you know that that's what her motivation is, how satisfying is that for the mother? Not just that her room is clean. You didn't have to go and do it yourself, she did it herself. Because she wanted to please you. That's very nice. That's very pleasing. So when the things that we do are done for the pleasure of God, that's what is recommended. Now, let's take what you speak about, or what you eat, or what you do. Let's take what you eat. When you invite someone to your home and you want to please them, you want to make something that's nice for them. So you could just make something that you like, but it may not be to their liking. Mm-hmm. You went through a nice endeavor to make something that they don't like. So you go the extra step and find out what they like. And you may not even be like so accustomed to making that particular thing that they like, but you make what they like. And the happiness they feel is not just that you brought something that they like, but you went out of your way to do something that they like. It's the love, not just the item. That's what is pleasing to Krishna. So he says in Bhagavad Gita, he's very easy to please. Patram pushpam palam toyam yo me bhaktya prayachati. So, patram, leaf, a flower, palam, fruit, some water. Very easy to get, any one of those things. And you offer to Krishna with love and devotion. He's very pleased. Not costly, readily available, anyone can get those things. But it's the love and devotion. But more, I'm emphasizing, what's most important is the love and devotion with which we do those things that are pleasing to Krishna. I'll offer a same idea expressed a little differently. Something that all parents, this is like the difference between Mahabharata and the essence of Bhagavad Gita, the transcendental part. The difference between goodness and transcendence. One of the things that parents always like to train their children is to say please and thank you in any culture of the world. Someone gives something to the child and the mother says, and what do you say? Please. And then they get the something, and then the mother says, and what do you say? Thank you. Very nice. And, you know, so they get they're learning how to say please and thank you, how to be nice. But how to teach your child feelings of gratitude? That's a whole other level of training and educating a child. I was sharing this once in an assembly like this, and somebody was a school teacher, and their light went on. They said, we've been teaching this in our classroom, in our home, you know, that the educators have been thinking about it and talking about it, and we've come to the conclusion we can't. We can teach them behavior, but to experience the feeling of gratitude, we don't know how to do it. But when there's gratitude in the heart, then when you say or somehow do, or you know, your life becomes an expression of thank you, that's what's pleasing. So how to learn to recognize that which we have received, ultimately it may be coming from our parents or the store down the street or something like that, but ultimately it's coming from God. So one of the things that we can do to please God is feel gratitude for all the wonderful things in our life. And even feel gratitude for the challenging things of our life, because they can also be opportunities to help us grow and become more mature and become stronger. And offer that to God. And that's the more involved answer. A simpler answer is those things that you commonly do, see how you can do them as an offering unto Krishna. This is called Karma Yoga. Yad Kuroshi, Yad Asnasi, Yad Jahosi, the Dasi, Yad Yatapasyasi Konteya, Tatkarasha, Madarpanam. Arpana means worship. So those things that you do conventionally in life, do that as a form of worship to God. That's Karma Yoga, it's not yet bhakti. But, you know, you do your household duties. Do them in the spirit that this is a worship, this is a service unto God. I'm cooking, I'm cleaning, I'm training, I'm dressing, and, you know, going to the market, I'm doing the things that I do in my daily life. Let me think how this can be done in such a way that it'll be pleasing to God. It's Karma Yoga, I'm emphasizing. It's not yet necessarily with full consciousness of the Supreme. So you can connect that, which is like theistic conduct, with something that will directly connect your consciousness with God, starting with chanting of God's holy name. And do that as part of your daily sadhana, your daily discipline of life. Your morning, okay, I get my body clean, put on clean clothes, now let make my inside clean. Let me make my heart clean. And then I can direct things to God. So some daily devotional practice in the privacy of your heart, in your home, in a sanctified place, and offer your prayers and your worship unto Krishna. And it's a very simple form, is what we were doing at the very beginning of the program, calling God's holy name. And do that every day. I mean, maybe not for as long as we did this evening, but each day for some time. And hear the message as Krishna speaking to elevate Arjuna to that position. And when you hear that message regularly, your consciousness becomes elevated to that position. And then all the things that you do become acts of worship of the Supreme, naturally. Okay. And your children can take part. They can have kirtan with you. And make offerings of your food to Krishna. They can take part. Hearing stories about Krishna. Once you start that in the home, they won't, you know, leave you alone. Every night you'll have to tell them a story about Krishna. And then it's beneficial for them and beneficial for you, and devotion for Krishna awakens in the heart. Just like these, I was thinking at the beginning, where you have the small children sitting around in the front, that little boy with his, you know, t-shirt. These young ladies here were like that. As your daughter, you know, I'm almost six. And now they're, you know, in college or soon to go to college, but they've had that their whole lives. And these young men, same. And the spirit of devotion is within their life, as within their parents, because they took that daily devotional practice and tried to take the message of Bhagavad Gita and bring it within their heart and live by it. Do you have a question? Okay. Anyone else? Back there, you have a question? No? Okay. Yes.
Guru Maharaj, sometimes I've received arguments saying that I'm okay. I do not need, why should I need to, why do I need to chant, or what do I need to know about this? So I'm not in a place. I do not have a level of relationship with the people I'm speaking to say, convince them one way or the other. So what should, more than my response, what should my...
Very much depends upon the individual, individual by individual, what's appropriate. You're maybe one of the things that you can do is adjust what you feel that your relationship with them is. It's not like, you know, your relationship is to tell them something. But here's a soul, like me, they're on a journey. And their journey is, if they're asking something about spiritual life or spiritual practice, then that's a beginning of inquisitive spirit. So, you can try to hear from them what is it that interests you about spiritual life. Well, you know, maybe what interests me is, I'm just not sure if it's, you know, how important is it? You know, or I look at you and I say, you're a nice person, but why are you doing this? You know, what do you get out of it? You know, find out what is of interest to them and address that. Well, I can tell you what I get out of it. This is what happened. You know, there was a time when I also wasn't chanting, and then there was a time when I began chanting God's holy name. And now I'm chanting very regularly in a very, you know, determined way. And I can tell you what that experience is like. How it's impacted on my life. If that's what they're interested in, well, you know, why are you doing it? If it's like more generic, why should anyone do it? Then there's scriptural teachings that say what the chanting of God's holy name does. The principle is when one in contact with something that's supremely pure, one becomes purified. And I can say for myself, becoming more purified is something I aspire for. I may not even know exactly what that means. I have something of an idea what that means, but I may not know exactly what that means. But it's something that, it, you know, inspires me. I want to put some energy into that. So, try different things that will bring purification into your life, and here's one of them. And here's some different indications of different traditions that apply the same principle. Whether it's done this way, that way, or the other way, calling upon God's holy name. My mind is going to, just before coming back from India, I was in a city in South India, and very near where I was staying, there was a Muslim mosque. And every morning at 5:12, Allah! And so many prayers, and then, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, Allah, and, you know, so many prayers. So they have their way of expressing. And we have this different way of expressing, but it's the same principle. It's a universal principle. It's a principle of purification of consciousness, to bring our consciousness more in harmony or in alignment with God's will. So it's good for souls to purify. Sarvatma snapanam param vijayate Shri Krishna sankirtanam. Depends on the individual. Something? I'm looking at you. No? Okay. Yes.
You mentioned something about a father's love for his children, and you know, he loves all the children equally. And in one conversation with someone else, was trying to indicate something to that effect, and that person was saying, no, it's not like that. There is some partiality.
Well, there's partiality in us, perhaps, but within God, there's not. He's a perfect being, and as the perfect being, he has love equally. He's describing that about himself. And one who is similarly a jiva soul, the individual soul, fixed in transcendence, sees like that too. Pandita Samadarshana. So for us, there's attraction, repulsion, like and dislike, pleasure, pain. There's duality. And for the Supreme, it's the realm of that which is absolute. Not the push and the pull of duality. Like, dislike, friend, enemy. Attraction, repulsion of sense objects. Yes.
Maharaj, you spoke about performing one's duty with abandoning virtue. And I'm wondering if you can give an example, because it seems that performing one's duty is a virtuous thing. So what would be, it seems to be equivalent. But you mentioned that in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna teaches that one should perform one's duty with abandoning virtue. If you can give an example of that.
Well, it's not only abandoning duty, what Krishna is speaking about beyond, in addition to that, is staying fixed in God consciousness. Being in transcendence without abandoning virtue. How one can be on the platform of the absolute without losing contact of virtue and vice, of right and wrong, proper and improper conduct. So, let's go to Bhagavad Gita or Mahabharata. And in many circumstances, Bhishma, he wanted to smash the Kauravas. And Yudhisthira said no. And because Yudhisthira said no, he didn't do it. Because the principle was respect for his brother, although his spirit was, you know, warrior. But he withdrew that by submission to a religious principle. And in overall, the Pandavas were by religious principle had every reason, I mean, according to religious codes, to take force. But he was prepared, Arjun was prepared to just let go of all that. You know, attempted murder, stealing their property, defiling their wife, so many reasons, extremely, you know, in a court of law or by the religious codes, punishable, severely punishable. And Arjuna was prepared to walk away. But Krishna placed, let's consider what the duty of the soul is first. Who is the soul and what's the duty of the soul? And then connected to the duty of the soul comes what follows. From the one principle suspended are the other principles. And then you can determine what is the duty of the soul without abandoning virtue. The transcendental standard of virtue. Then it comes back to her question. How do we please God? Or how do we know what he wants? So there's some scriptural indication of what he wants. And then there's guidance of how do you apply that scripture by qualified persons, by qualified Brahmins and Vaishnavas, how to apply those principles. And one who adheres to that Another example. So one who adheres to that is following that principle. Doing one's duty unto God without abandoning virtue. Bhishma Dev's consoling Yudhisthira was like that. After the battle was over, he was beside himself with grief. He's now the emperor, but he's thinking, so that I can be emperor, so many people had to lose their lives on both sides, so that I can become emperor? How horrible. He was grief-stricken, although he's the emperor. And different persons tried to console him, and finally Bhishma Dev was able to console him. That, you know, the principle of pursuing what was the will of Krishna under the guidance of the brahmanas, and with that purpose of simply to please him. And that by applying that principle in one's life, the results are up to God. We can't create a different result than the result that is created by God. It's up to him. So now perform your duty. The whole world is waiting. They want a noble king, and you are that king, and that's what Krishna wanted. Now perform your duty. He became convinced. Then his question was, how do I perform my duty? Not like, I don't want to do it, but how do I perform it? What are the duties of a king in relation to all the other social orders of life, etc.? But those were secondary behind the primary. The souls connecting with the Supreme, following behind that is the standards of virtue, and then the details of how you lead a virtuous life without compromising virtue. While doing duties in the world. That so many times seem to compromise, or like it's moving in that direction, and to say no, and not move in that direction. Stay firm in virtue. And the anchor is this, unto the Supreme, all perform all activities for the pleasure of God. It's a universal principle. It's one of the beautiful features of Bhagavad Gita. It's not just an ism. This ism versus that ism. It's principles. Universal principles. Anything else? Okay. You have something more?